Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
Okay, here you are once again. Welcome back. As we explore the exciting world, the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online at promiseoftomorrow.biz. We're commercial-free and have been now for several years, and so we're supported, of course, by contributions from the science community. We're going to check in with Akemo Storkey. He's with KAS Consulting in Austin, Texas. He's got a nice prediction for the future. He's going to tell us about financing renewables. So if you're into renewable energy and you're looking for ways of getting financed, Akemo is the guy to explain it to us. We're going to get to him in just a little bit. And that brings me then to remind you about the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference going on in Seattle, Washington, October 21st through the 24th this year. Bring your solutions, if you have renewables, bring your solutions in engineering, science, technology, and a broad range, vital components urgently needed for the world's humanitarian survival. Right now we hear about the terrible things going on in the Sudan, and the badly needed water, power infrastructure, off-grid power renewables, and sustainable energy, all sorts of different things, health, medical technology, telemedicine, and that sort of stuff, all being discussed at the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference, and you can find out more about it at IEEEGHTC.org. That's I-E-E-E-E. That should be three E's. I-E-E-E. And Global Humanitarian Technology Conference, or GHTC.org. Also on the program, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from some of us have never heard of. Visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set. That's in the second half of the program. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, so I know how much you really enjoy visiting our very noisy world newsroom. So I want you to step in here with me for just a little bit. And check this out. I know you like to come in here as often as we can, and generally we don't have a whole lot of time, but today we've got a few minutes before we get to today's guest, Akemo Storkey. And let's see what happens. This is, of course, the nerve center of the Science News Radio Network, where our reporters check the news wires on a regular basis and then clip the stories that look like they could be developed and put them here up here on the bulletin board. And they're called news... we call them our news clips, and we look these over and see what we can find out. There's a lot of really fascinating things that that we get here, and here's one out of R&D Magazine, 15 years of work by the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory's National Ignition Facility team paid off on the 5th of July, and you may not have noticed. There was a historic, record-breaking laser shot. Yep, the laser system of 192 beams delivered more than 500 terawatts of peak power to its target. Now, let's put that in perspective. 500 terawatts, that's 1,000 times more power than the United States uses at any instant in time. And they say it's a critical requirement for achieving one of physics' grand challenges. Of course, igniting hydrogen fusion fuel in the laboratory and producing more energy than that supplied to the target. As we've talked about in this program many times, MIT is actually doing fusion, but the only problem is using more energy to create the fusion than the fusion is creating. So that's been pretty tough. But the laser community is pretty happy with this. Richard Petrosso, he's a senior research scientist and division head of high energy density physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He says, and this is a quote, the 500 terawatt shot is an extraordinary accomplishment by the NIF team, creating unprecedented conditions in the laboratory that hitherto only existed deep in stellar interiors, close quote. But he does go on to say that for scientists across the nation and the world, who like ourselves are actively pursuing fundamental science under extreme conditions and the goal of laboratory fusion ignition, this is a remarkable and exciting achievement. So, all right, let's step out of our busy newsroom. What do you say? A little noisy in here. And let's get on and dial up today's guests. Here we go. Right now, I want to introduce you to a guy I've been talking to now for a couple of years out of Austin, Texas, Kimo Storkey. He's with KAS Consulting Group and a fascinating character. And finally, I've managed to convince Kimo to come on the program. Welcome to the program, Kimo.
Hey, Colonel, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Now, KAS Consulting Group, we've had some great conversations, and I want to talk to you right now about financing for renewables, because, you know, you and I get back to the question again about how viable are these renewables with all the thing that's going on right now with the new findings in natural gas and that big stuff. You know, where are renewables going, and if somebody's really serious about renewables, what's the picture look like?
No, yeah, thank you, Colonel. You know, in the renewable space, it's such a nascent market in relation to solar, wind being a bit more mature. But some of the things like geothermal, solar, biomass, they're so new that the development life cycle on them and the financing life cycle on them still needs to be kind of matured. Mm-hmm. And so in a nascent market like that, you need to be able to know how to approach the money in the right way at the right time. And so structured finance or project finance is actually a bit of an art that needs to be pulled together in one fall swoop. And so I think the important thing that, you know, when we talk to CEOs on a daily basis is helping them walk through what are the stages of project financing.
Yeah, well, that's cool, but as I understand, you know, these private financing likes a real quick turnaround, and the question that I always run into, I'm talking to these people with renewables and that sort of thing, they got these great dreams and these great ideas and that sort of stuff, and they promote, you know, approach a private financing organization and say, you know, what's the turnaround of this thing? We want a 2 or 3 year turnaround, and some of these people are looking like 8 or 10 years out. What are you seeing?
No, that's actually true on some of these renewable projects. It is taking a long time, especially in the solar space, because a lot of them are based on a combination of things that make them profitable, and mostly right now it's, frankly, you know, incentives by the government. And so your upfront costs, you know, if you stretch them out, it takes a long time for the repayment of monies. So, yes, you're right. Typically we're seeing between, you know, 7 and 10 years just to get your money back. But then for the next 15 or so years, you obviously have a steady stream of income for the people that invest in them. And so, you know, when we approach these developers and as they go through their life cycle of development, there's a bunch of components related to financing that need to come into play. First off, you've got what I call early stage construction financing, which is your private equity type, and they, you know, they put in the early money to make sure that the projects get to a construction phase.
Mm-hmm.
And then the construction phase is really the point in which you have to build this complete solution together. So everything comes into play here, Colonel. You've got debt, you've got infrastructure funds, you've got tax equity, both federal and state, and you have to bring those all together in one fall swoop to get them done. And so that's the construction phase. And then there's the commissioning phase, which basically that's where an infrastructure fund, so the commissioning is, you know, when a project is up and going. And then an infrastructure fund would come in and either buy it out from somebody, because like a developer, much similar to real estate, you have some people that work on projects that either want to keep them and they want to sell them, or they want to do a bit of both. And so that would be the commissioning phase. And then there's another phase, which, you know, the project is kind of spinning, or the, you know, the, in the wind world it's spinning, or producing power, and then that's the divestiture. And so that would be someone who has a very large portfolio of projects, and they've been around for a while, and, you know, they're producing income, and they want to just sell them off. And that typically the people that buy those are insurance companies or pure play infrastructure funds. And they're looking for a steady income, for a modest return, for a long period of time, for their people, like, and again, insurance companies or, you know, annuity funds. And so what we're talking about there something between 8% and 10%, you know, for a 20-year annual yield, which, you know, obviously beats, you know, being sticking it in the bank or putting it into a bond.
That seems to make a lot of sense, but it does lead to some pretty crazy questions. I mean, you know, are you sitting around with investment money waiting to be put into these operations, or do you have people with renewables that are coming forward to you all the time saying, "Hey, how do I get financed?" I mean, what's the market look like right now, and how do you keep this balance?
No, that's a great question. It's a little bit of both. So on a daily basis, what my firm does is we talk to the CEOs of these companies that may have projects in any stage of life that I told you about, whether it's development, construction, commissioning, or divestiture. And it's our job to figure out how to help them basically, you know, achieve their dream, which is to stand up a project or multiple projects. And so the conundrum that is always present is the project ready? And so there's certain criteria that need to be met before people get investment. You know, and again, the project finance space is very empirical in that you have data that you need that proves that the project is ready. And if that data is real, i.e. contracts, right? So engineering contracts, procurement contracts for equipment, construction contracts to build it, performance guarantees, all of these things need to be in place before the kind of money that invests in these kind of projects says yes. If they are in place, it's a go, no-go decision. It's not anything that is emotional, in a sense of, you know, like on the venture side, you say, well, you know, I think that's a good idea, I'll invest there. This is more very, very empirical and very much, give me these things, and if you give me these things and they match our criteria, we will invest.
All right, so what you're saying is there is investment money available right at the moment for people that will come aboard and will have these kind of this kind of homework done. Now, let's supposing that I got some great idea for some renewable and everything else. You help me formulate this so it can be presented to the investors, or would you send me away to go talk to some other people that could put this thing together, and all you'll do is just pick up the phone and call the investors?
No, we would formulate that exactly. So a lot of times, so part of, you know, my company's goal is to help the entrepreneur walk through, you know, this kind of path, right? It's kind of a wisdom kind of, you know, impartation thing that it's part of kind of like my passion to assist the entrepreneur or the, you know, the business owner to see this done, because I personally have a passion and believe that renewables and energy is in the United States is the way to go here and to bring us into independence. And so, you know, part of my goal is to honorably, if I can, walk with alongside the CEO of that company down that path. And so, yes, a lot of it is direction and guidance, and here's how you do this. And, you know, sometimes some companies aren't there. They don't have the intellectual capital, or their projects aren't truly there. But so in that case, I don't waste their time by, you know, kind of stringing them along at all. I just tell them, okay, look, here's what you got to deliver to me, A, B, C, and D. You look like you have A and B, and when you get C and D, call me back. And so a lot of it is basically walking alongside.
All right, well, Kimo, you know, you're sitting there in Austin, and you know you've got these investors that are saying, hey, you know, alert us to the good investments and things like that. But then do you just, you know, you wait for somebody to contact you because of your great reputation, or you're out scouting around looking for things, and how do you find them if that's the case?
No, that's a great question, too. A lot of it is, you know, like any other business development activity, you have to go scour around and meet people, and, you know, shake hands and kiss babies. And so, you know, what we do is we go to conferences and we meet a lot of good folks, or we have a fairly established network of people that have projects that we know of. And we, you know, after a while, if everything is based on a relationship, you build a good network, and people come to you with projects because they know that either you are good at doing what you say you can do or you're not.
What about government subsidies? Do they play a part in this? I mean, is there something from the Department of Energy or anything like that is pumping money into renewables that goes through you too that you could arrange, or how does that work?
Yeah, we're really not. I mean, we can find some of that tax equity, and it's very elusive. And government subsidies are, you know, doled out obviously on a national basis, but. That's a very good question, and frankly, that's why a lot of the solar projects and their wind projects are either stalled or only in certain locations, because in the solar world, you know, there's only 5 or 6 states that are actually doing anything right now. It's California, Arizona, Puerto Rico, which is obviously the territory, Hawaii, and a few others, but that's it. And it's because there's no subsidies that make them economically viable on a federal or state level. And then, you know, in the wind industry, we're seeing a bit of a glitch in relation to the production tax credit not being renewed by the government. And that is also a big issue because it will stall or is stalling right now wind projects that would normally be developed. And it's happened 3 times, and there's precedent here that it just totally almost decimates the wind industry. So we're right in the middle of that. We're really hoping and praying that the PTC gets extended by Congress, and that will kind of jumpstart again the projects that were in a pipeline to be developed, because right now they're stalled because there's no production tax credit for these projects that would be online. And so the money doesn't flow, the projects don't get built.
The Tribune Pickens a number of years ago, and not too many number of years ago either, a few years ago, was contacting me, several times a week about the projects he had going with wind. And then all of a sudden that stopped. And the word is that Tribune Pickens is walking away from his wind ideas and devoting his energy and time right now into natural gas. Does it look like the wind industry that was going great guns there, you know, for a little while, now is going to be something that has reached its peak and is going to kind of go away? Or how do you see that?
Yeah, that's a neat thing there what Boone is doing. It's because he has the pulse on really what is the energy du jour of the day, mm-hmm. right? And when he was doing wind, it was going great guns, and part of the reason he was doing that was actually the other side of that. Obviously, if you recall, he was trying to, you know, work on the transmission lines that needed to be built to south here.
Yeah.
And when that didn't occur, well, he stopped, because transmission is everything here in Texas and in the south. If you mm-hmm. can't move power from the remote locations where wind is at to the sources of where we consume power, you're done. And so Boone was, I think, wise in, you know, if he couldn't get the government to get the CREZ lines built or get behind what he was doing, he moved on. But to answer your question in relation to wind, I think wind is just, you know, it's actually a quite mature technology. It's the same thing, though. If we got to get these transmission lines built, so that's like another three to five years that they'll be mature and to the places where they need to be. We need to get this PTC done again. And when we get that, we'll just continue to roll. What you're seeing right now is the result of 5 years of development and a lot of wind farms actually coming online right now, because at the end of the year is when that PTC goes bye-bye. And so what we're seeing right now in 2012 is the fruit of 5 years worth of development, maybe 3 to 5 years worth of development. So there are a lot of projects getting stood up. But there will be more once we get these transmission lines all in place. And frankly, we'll get even a lot more when we get smart grids in place, because then we'll be able to monitor and meter these huge networks of energy in a better and more efficient way.
Well, the transmission lines, of course, and the smart grids, they can all handle electricity from any source. So, I mean, it isn't just wind, but, of course, wind is necessary to have these transmission lines for the wind to succeed. But there's so many people downplaying wind. They're saying, look, you know, it blows at a time when there isn't peak electrical use. It you've got to shut it down if all of a sudden there's a surge in, let's say, flooding or something like that, because the floodgates are causing more hydro to produce electricity, and wind, you know, is unreliable. You can't just call it up whenever you want to, so you got to go back to some sort of a fired electrical generation, and that the future for wind is pretty much over with, even if the new transmission lines are built, which have to be built anyway to carry power to the new power demands anyhow. I mean, do you disagree with that concept?
I think there's a great panacea in between base load and peak, Colonel, and that is really storage. And so a couple things need to occur for the storage of energy to take place, and that is, one, policy needs to change, and I'm pleased to say that it is changing slowly but surely. And then that will allow us then to kind of level out the peaks and the valleys between base load and peak demand. And so any other, you know, kind of the disruptive energy solution like wind or solar or biomass or geothermal will be able to become a little bit more predictable by the utilities because of storage, power electronics, which gives it, you know, intelligence, and allows then the utilities to bring online and execute peak demand power in a predictable manner, because that's what you don't have now. Is you got, oh my gosh, here's peak, and here's a wind farm, he's poking at me, what do I do with him? I don't know what to do with him because I can't manage him. Let's shut him off until I need him, and then I'll bring him back online. See, there's no way to, you know, bring this together in a manageable fashion.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so there are some really interesting companies that are doing storage solutions that actually mitigate some of this risk and bringing smart grid to, very heritage networks.
Mm-hmm. Well, smart grid, of course, is seen as a remarkable, wonderful, at least a short-term solution for this. But, you know, we've been talking about the storage problem for a long time. I mean, we've got mechanical storage and flywheels, and that's limited. Battery technology has not been advancing to the point that we really need to have it done. There's not much else way of storage. I guess hydro, you pump water up and you bring water down, but that's not that's expensive and not easy to do in all sorts of areas. I mean, really, this storage thing sure is a game changer, but when in the devil are we ever going to see the advancements in storage that we need to have? Do you see that anywhere on the horizon?
Oh, it's not, it's certainly not. I don't think in the next couple of years. There are some very interesting companies doing some very interesting things. But until policy changes, in the PUCs about storage, then we're going to see things happen. And so that's not going to be for a little while yet.
Well, I'm interested in what you mean exactly by policy changes. What are these policy changes with the PUC as far as storage goes?
Well, in other words, right now, as far as I know, and I'm a neophyte here in the PUC world, but policies need to change in relation to utilities actually being able to utilize storage.
Okay.
There's no policies in relation to, how to store it, how to use it, where to put it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there's no way of storing it. I mean, the ways of storing it are really crippled, or let's say anemic would be a better word. And so, how can a POC change affect that?
Well, a policy needs to set forth first on actually being able to address it. Once you address it, and then there are technologists that weigh in on the policy level, that bring what I would call, specific language in relation to the storage, the usage, and the implementation of it. The technology behind it, okay, that still needs to be, ironed out, but there are more general, larger issues in relation to policy that need to get put in place. And I personally know that some of those things are happening, so I'm encouraged that they are. But there's still baby steps, and I think that storage as part of the smart grid, is still 3 to 5 years out.
And we've been talking largely about wind, but you also, we touched on solar, and of course wind and solar have similar similar drawbacks and similar attributes. I mean, the sun only shines a certain amount of the time, too, so it's got to rely on storage, and it doesn't create electricity when it's too cloudy outside and that sort of thing. So we talk about renewables. You do all sorts of renewables. What other sort of renewables would be viable other than wind and solar?
Well, right now, the problem with...
Okay, I need you to hold that thought for a minute while we take a break and be right back.
As we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers, will we meet today?
Out of the distant past comes to you, me, the wisdom of Plato. One of the penalties for refusing to participate in politics is that you end up being governed by your inferiors. Oh.